Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 18th of February, these are our main stories. Health officials in China have published details of the largest study to date of the new coronavirus, which shows a fatality rate of 2.3%. Europe's biggest bank, HSBC, says it will axe 35,000 jobs after pre-tax profits fell by a third last year. We hear what it's like to get caught up in a swarm of locusts as South Sudan braces for their arrival. Also in this podcast, why is the Amazon boss Jeff Bezos, the world's richest person, pledging $10 billion to help tackle climate change?
Definitely seems like an effort to try and win over some support from the activist community. Amazon has been hammered for its huge environmental footprint.
And we talked to a Russian activist who's been under house arrest for more than a year. The director of a leading hospital in Wuhan, the Chinese city where the coronavirus outbreak began, has died. He's one of the most senior officials to have been killed by COVID-19 so far. And the announcement coincides with a new study that underlines the high risk to medical staff. The Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention published the first details of more than 44,000 cases of the virus. The findings put the overall death rate at 2.3%. To hear more about this latest report and the conclusions that were drawn about who's most at risk, I spoke to our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
This is really the first, big release of data we've had from the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. So as you said, looking at almost 45,000 confirmed cases of the virus. Now, 80% of those cases, those people had mild symptoms, they recovered. And so that brings us to the remaining 20%. A large chunk of those people experienced severe pneumonia. And that leads us to a mortality rate of 2.3%. Now, that's lower than other serious viruses we've seen, SARS, MERS included. However, it does seem to be quite a contagious disease, and so that's really worrying researchers. We're seeing that 64% of the people who've died are men, and it seems that if you're in your 60s, 30% of deaths are people in their 60s, 30% people in their 70s, 20% people in their 80s. So it does seem to affect older people.
And the research also points to the high risk to medical staff. What efforts is China making to retain those frontline workers?
Well, it's really Chinese authorities are finding themselves in a really difficult position. Just today, they've announced that they're opening another 10 makeshift hospitals in Wuhan. That's the city at the center of the outbreak. Of course, they're going to need staff to service these hospitals. And that's really the problem. They've been announcing incentives for frontline medical workers. They say that anybody who dies while serving as a frontline medical worker will be considered a martyr. That's a really big deal in China. Those people, their families are given preferential treatment. They're given special pensions throughout their lives. And of course, the children of frontline workers, all frontline workers, will be given special places in schools. They'll be given priority placements in kindergartens through to university placements. And so that might be a huge incentive to more hospital staff to volunteer to go and work in Wuhan.
Celia Hatton, Africa recorded its first case of the coronavirus on Friday in Egypt. The patient is reportedly not Egyptian and is now in isolation in hospital. Local health experts are concerned that if the virus takes hold, it could be extremely difficult to contain. China is one of Africa's main trading partners, with constant movement of people and goods across borders. Our correspondent Pumza Filani has this report from Johannesburg.
So you can see, if the suit is not the right fit, right, the zip is going to fold like this and you're going to struggle.
In Sibugeng Township in the south of Johannesburg, a group of paramedics are watching a colleague put on a medical safety suit with gloves, goggles and face mask.
So what is he going to do now?
Wash hands.
So he washes his hands.
They are being trained on what to do if coronavirus comes to South Africa.
The nice thing about these guys is that they deal with infectious diseases every day. So basically what we're doing now is just refreshing them on those procedures.
This is JP van Bjerneke, a paramedic. He says they are already receiving dozens of calls every day from people who are worried they have the virus. So they run through a checklist before leaping into action. Like, for instance, has the person been to China?
And then what they look is which area of China. They look at contact history. So just merely being in China but without contact to somebody with coronavirus would not fill the case definition. And then we look for something like a fever, symptoms like a runny nose, a sore throat, like your flu symptoms, a headache.
Hello. How are you today?
In Johannesburg's Chinatown district, a vibrant street of vegetable markets, restaurants and grocery stores, some people are wearing face masks. They tell me this is just a precaution.
So people who've recently come back from China have decided to stay away from the business district. I'm standing in front of one shop. It's a restaurant that's been closed for about 10 days now. I'm told the owner has decided to stay away to try and keep people from panicking.
Michael Sun, a community leader, says they are doing what they can to detect any possible signs of the virus.
A lot of the Chinese shopping center owners, they're taking precautionary measures. They've got a team of staff going to the shopkeepers with forehead thermometers to measure temperatures, just to say, hey guys, we want you to be healthy. A lot of the sanitizing is going on. If you go visit the Chinatowns, business is fairly quiet.
The global public health community believes that it still may be possible to contain the spread of this virus and not give rise to a global outbreak.
Currently, only a few centres across Africa are able to test for the virus. Professor Cheryl Cohen works at one of them, South Africa's National Institute of Communicable Diseases.
We know that Africa experiences a very high impact from seasonal influenza, and therefore it is likely that the African continent will experience a higher impact should there be a global outbreak. And I think that really needs to be a focus of the global community, you know, really to strengthen health systems in African countries and put in place practical measures to mitigate the potential impact of such an outbreak.
With Africa having recorded its first case of coronavirus, the preparations being made now will be key to how well a potential outbreak is contained.
Phumza Philani with that report from Johannesburg. Europe's biggest bank, HSBC, has reported a big drop in profits. It made more than $13 billion before tax in 2019, compared with nearly $20 billion a year earlier. That's a fall of about a third, much worse than analysts had predicted. It's also announced it's planning to cut about 35,000 jobs as part of a major restructuring. I asked our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker, what had gone wrong for the bank.
It's worth bearing in mind that for all the difficulty, it is still making a profit. You mentioned one measure. There are various different ways of looking at profits, but another one that's what's called profit attributable to shareholders actually fell by even more. It was down by half to a figure of $6 billion. Now, that's a lot of money, but nonetheless, the chief executive says that there are parts of the business that are not delivering acceptable returns. The particular issue that led to this marked fall was an accounting thing that by which the bank had to revalue a lot of its assets in line with lower expectations about economic growth globally. So they had been making assumptions that the world economy was going to be performing rather better than it had. And it's been particularly a struggle, I think, for them in their investment banking business. So this is the share trading, the providing certain kinds of financial advice to big businesses. That has been an area where they have struggled, and they have also struggled a bit with their retail network in the United States.
So which parts of the bank will be most affected
by
the job cuts?
We've not got any numbers spelt out on a regional basis or indeed on a basis of divisions within the bank. But those two areas that I mentioned, I think, are where we are likely to see significant job losses occurring. The investment banking business, so that's a large presence in the city of London here, and there will be closures, I think, of some of the retail banking operations, the bank branches in the United States.
And briefly, Andrew, the company has warned that the coronavirus outbreak could affect or further affect its revenue?
Well, it is worth remembering that almost half of the bank's revenue comes from Asia. So it's hardly surprising that it has all these interrelations, businesses that it does with companies in the areas that are most affected by the virus, where supply chains are going to be disrupted. So I think it's inevitable that there will be some knock-on effect on the bank's own performance.
Andrew Walker. The chief executive of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, has pledged $10 billion to help tackle climate change. In a social media post, he said he was setting up a fund that would give grants to projects that would help fight what he called the biggest threat to our planet. Amazon has faced growing criticism for the level of emissions from its delivery vehicles and for packaging waste. Julia Piper is a fellow at the Atlantic Council, a nonpartisan body seeking solutions to global challenges. What does she make of the Amazon announcement?
More money to address a pressing issue like climate change is a good thing. Immediately, though, there are questions around how the money will be deployed, right? We still don't really know what the timeline is for deployment. Is this over a couple years, a decade? It wasn't immediately clear how that would roll out. And what is the oversight process? Who will determine who the grantees are? Grants will be given out as soon as this summer, apparently. But how will they be selected? Will there be diversity?
If you're getting private money rather than guaranteed government money, that means that your work is, you know, on a different basis. Activists, what does that mean? Does that mean that Extinction Rebellion will go and block Amazon delivery drivers? You know, there's lots of questions to answer that way, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like an effort to try and, you know, win over some support from the activist community. Amazon has been hammered for its huge environmental footprint, its carbon footprint, and being kind of cagey around how much action it's willing to take. It is planning to adopt renewables. Bezos has said he wants to have 100% renewables by 2030 and achieve net zero emissions by 2040. But even then, you know, it hasn't been super transparent with how much emissions it produces. And so these groups are rightly, you know, questioning the company's commitment.
What is the issue with Amazon? It's not only the network of shipping and delivery, which obviously one can imagine spewing out greenhouse gases, but there's also the issue of computing, about how expensive that is on a carbon footprint.
Yes, exactly. It's the cars and trucks that it takes to get products places, and then also the data to run its website and manage all the logistics here. Then, you know, there's also secondary emissions, and there's bigger questions around the customers that Amazon serves. One of the biggest things that activists have called the company out for is continuing to work with oil and gas companies on technology solutions, on logistics solutions. Amazon's a huge company, does lots of different things. So one of their things is working with the oil and gas industry. And so Greenpeace and others have really tried to urge Amazon to stop working with those entities, including Amazon's own employees. There's a group of them that are really urging the company to step away from that sector entirely.
Should I think harder about having Amazon stuff sent to my door with all the expenses that takes? Or should I be pleased that the company is obviously making such a large donation to mitigate that?
I think, you know, people have the right to do whatever they'd like. But I think if you want to be more conscious about your environmental footprint, 110%, you should do that. And that includes all the decisions you make in your life. It has a role to play. But I also think that we have to pressure the biggest entities on Earth to do more, because they are the ones that have, you know, the ability to make systems-wide change. They have the balance sheets to do it. And one small change from Amazon has enormous impacts on the overall, you know, carbon emissions that we see globally. So I think the answer is both. I think you can feel a little bit better about making your purchase, but maybe you want to, you know, buy a little less or reuse a little more at the same time.
Julia Piper from the U.S.-based Atlantic Council speaking there to my colleague Lawrence Pollard. Locusts are threatening food supplies across East Africa, with swarms now reaching as far as South Sudan. Our Africa editor, Mary Harper, told me about her first encounter with a swarm of locusts.
I was living in Senegal at the time, and the first the kind of sight of them, I was driving in the car, and suddenly the sky basically went completely black, and there was just this sort of thwacking sound on the windscreen, sort of like that, but even louder. And we turned on the windscreen wipers to try to get these rather large, very hard, mass amount of insects away, but that failed. So we basically had to wait for the swarm of locusts to pass us by. And then after that, I was in my home, I was in my room, and I heard this really strange noise, sort of like this. And outside my room, there was a mango tree, which was very much in leaf. And the locust had landed on that tree, and within about half an hour or even less, that tree was stripped of every bit of green. They had devoured the whole thing. So you imagine people who live on agriculture with their crops, a swarm of locusts will come and then they will be left with absolutely nothing.
Mary Harper. Still to come in this podcast, we speak to the lifeboatman who found a ghost ship lost at sea without its crew for more than a year while out for a morning jog. Anastasia Shevchenko is a political activist in Russia who's currently under house arrest and facing a 6-year jail sentence. She's accused of links to a pro-democracy group, Open Russia UK, which has been banned as undesirable and a threat to state security. Our correspondent Sarah Rainsford was given special permission to travel to Rostov-on-Don in southern Russia to talk to her.
The weather in southern Russia is miserable. But Bale is happy enough, off to splash through dirty puddles of melting snow. His owner's not bothered by the slush either. After 13 months under strict house arrest, the opposition activist Anastasia Shevchenko has just been given permission for a short daily walk.
When you stay at home for such a long time, there are things you miss. It's not only the sun and fresh air, it's also how wind touches your skin even, because you don't feel it at all. And I'm very excited because I can meet my son at school.
Outside that school, there's a babushka smashing ice off the pavement with an axe. Misha soon comes running through the gates and straight into his mum's arms. She tells me the 8-year-old has taken her arrest really hard. He has nightmares.
When the police came, they cried all night, my daughter and my son, and I saw their photos with red eyes. It's like a nightmare, you know, but if you are a political activist in Russia, you just have to be prepared somehow for prison.
Back at the flat, Anastasia shows me a file of documents from her case. She switches to Russian to speak more freely. She was banned from talking to anyone outside her family until now. The activist is accused of links to a pro-democracy group that's banned here. Open Russia UK is listed as an undesirable foreign organisation. She's been called a threat to state security. But the whole case is based on a public political debate and a protest with a banner against President Putin.
I think it's clear that this case and others like it are to stop opposition activists, those who want to take part in politics, to frighten them, to say, we won't allow it. If you are active, you'll end up suffering like her.
As Anastasia makes Misha a hot dog smeared in ketchup for his tea, she shows me the electronic tag on one ankle.
That's how they control me. They always know where I am. Yeah, it's uncomfortable when you are getting dressed, especially tights. It takes, I guess, 15 minutes to take them off.
It's far better than prison, though. Anastasia spent 2 nights in custody with cockroaches and a hole in the floor for a toilet. The family are trying to keep things as normal as possible. Misha practices a poem for his homework, and his sister, in a rainbow onesie, is glued to her mobile phone. But they all admit they feel uneasy these days, ever since they found out that investigators had put a spy camera in Anastasia's bedroom. Even so, she said she wanted to speak out because she's afraid Russia will turn into something like North Korea. And she told me she doesn't want that future for her children.
Sarah Rainsford reporting from Rostov-on-Don. brain evidence is playing an increasing role in criminal trials around the world, with defense lawyers sometimes arguing that defendants lack the capacity to control their actions. Now, a new study of 700 people in New Zealand appears to show that certain types of criminals have smaller brains and could struggle to stop their antisocial behavior. Stephanie Prentice has been looking into the research.
This study examined a few different groups of people who'd all been involved in either antisocial behaviour or criminal acts using MRI scans. And the biggest finding was that the group that engaged in what they called lifelong and persistent antisocial behaviour appeared to have abnormal brain development. And what that looked like is the brains were smaller and the membrane was thinner. Now, this is a theory that's actually been around since the early 90s, but this study is the first large-scale one that uses longitudinal data, so studying people over the course of their lives. Another key finding was that the subgroup that committed crimes as adolescents and then stopped as they reached adulthood exhibited normal brain development and size.
What are the implications of the findings, though? What can we do with this info?
So something the team who worked on this are very keen to stress is that not all offenders should be tarred with the same brush when it comes to things like justice policy. And also for that group I mentioned that are persistent offenders and have those abnormalities, they should be offered more support. So in a sense, treating them like a group that have some level of disability. Now, just before we came on air, I spoke to Dr. Christina Carlisi, and she's the lead author of the study.
Our study from New Zealand is fairly representative of most Western societies. Policy approaches to juvenile offending tend to sort of swing back and forth between very punitive measures and approaches that give young offenders room to reform. Our findings really ultimately support that for the small proportion of individuals with lifelong antisocial behavior, there may be structural differences in their brain that make it difficult for them to develop social skills that prevent them from engaging in antisocial behavior. And it's these people who could benefit from more support throughout their lives.
So that was Dr. Christina Carlisi. And on that final point she made, she also told me that due to neural plasticity, so the brain's ability to change due to environment, those physical differences could be subject to change.
Stephanie Prentice. The authorities in Ireland are warning the public to stay away from a so-called ghost ship, which washed up on rocks on Sunday after drifting crewless on the high seas for more than a year. The MV Alta became disabled south of Bermuda in 2018 following a massive storm, prompting the U.S. Coast Guard to rescue its 10-man crew. Alex Ritson has been speaking to Barry MacDonald, the man who found the ship.
My brother was on to me since, like, something out of Enid Blyton or the Famous Five.
Completely. What did you see?
I went down and there's a cliff walk close by to where it is, and I go for a run on it every now and then. And just when I got down into the little inlet there, the bay, I could smell the fuel. And I thought it was just a fuel spill in the car park or on the road there. And as I ran out the pathway, it just came into view out on the west, across the bay, kind of just in a little cove, just a big ship. And I couldn't believe it. I was kind of astounded, confused.
So were you the first person to find it?
Yes. I couldn't believe that I was the first person to see it, but I was. I'm also on the lifeboat crew in Ballycotton, and I would have presumed we would have been called out had there such a vessel been in trouble or floundering on the coast there.
You must have assumed that there were people on board.
What I assumed is they were now taken off, because to see a ship there, I presume that as we weren't called out on the lifeboat, I presume the helicopter, the Coast Guard, had taken them off, and so they didn't need the lifeboat and the vessel was just left there.
So what did you do next?
Well, when I got back to my car, I said, well, I better ring it in just to check, you know, and I rang the Coast Guard and I said, look, I actually said, you know, I presume you've got a call already, but I'm just checking. There's a big vessel on the rocks here and just west of Ballycotton. And he said, well, I'll just check now. And yeah, he said, no, we haven't heard anything. So he said, no, I'll get our local unit out. And the Coast Guard unit, the Cliff Rescue, and they went down and had a look.
What do you know about the vessel now?
It was abandoned somewhere east of Bermuda or down in the Caribbean somewhere. It lost engine power and they couldn't fix it. And it was like, I think, 1,300 miles off Puerto Rico or somewhere. And there was a storm approaching. So I think the American Coast Guard took them off October 2018. Then there's more stories that it drifted for a while and was taken by pirates in Guyana and then drifted on again. And the British Navy came across it in the middle of the Atlantic in September 2019 and just came up alongside and had a look to see was there anybody on board or what the problem was. But they found it was empty and just left it going its merry way until it next seen Ballycotton Sunday morning.
Presumably this is something that's going to go down in the folklore of Ballycotton. It's going to be something you tell your children about and they'll tell their children.
That's the sense around the place is like wrecks like this are kind of, were taught to be a thing of the past. That you would never see something so big end up on the shore. There has been a lot of talk of all the old wrecks over the years that and this seems to be a new addition to it. All right.
Barry MacDonald, a local lifeboat volunteer who found the so-called ghost ship. The Boy Scouts of America have filed for bankruptcy protection. A spokesman said the move would allow the group to keep running as it faces increasing legal costs related to allegations of sexual abuse. Elettra Naismith reports.
The Boy Scouts of America is one of the biggest youth organizations in the United States and one of the oldest, but financial pressures are growing. It's facing a surge in lawsuits over its handling of sexual abuse allegations. The organization has records dating back over a century. Lawyers argue those records hid the abuse problem and left scouts at risk. One victim's group has found nearly 2,000 complainants, ranging in age from 8 to 93. A scout spokesman said bankruptcy protection meant victims could be compensated. He apologised sincerely to anyone who was harmed.
Now, the American singer Billie Eilish has already won 5 Grammys so far this year and sung at the Oscars. On Tuesday, she's set to give her first live performance of the new James Bond theme at the Brit Awards here in London, where she's nominated in 4 categories. The singer's signature whispering style has gained her a global fan base, but she's told the BBC that she had to step back from reading social media feeds because of trolling.
I stopped reading comments fully.
Because?
Because it was ruining my life.
Was it?
Once again. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. Like, the cooler the things you get to do are, the more people hate you. It's crazy.
What do we do about that? How do we make it better?
I don't know, dude. It's crazy. Mm. Cancel culture is insane. I mean, that's not what has been happening. It's just been, like, just the internet is a bunch of trolls, you know? Mm. And it's, like, the problem is a lot of it's really funny. I think that's the issue. That's why nobody really stops, because it's funny.
And it doesn't matter how big a star you are, how many Grammys you got, what it still can hurt.
It's like, it's worse. It's, like, way worse than it's ever been right now.
So, playing at the Brits tonight.
Crazy.
So that's crazy for you, even at this stage? Do you feel nervous?
Yeah. I'm just nervous to hit the bell, to hit that high note. I'm terrified. First time ever. So please take it easy on me. I'm scared.
That was Billie Eilish and her songwriter brother Phineas. And let's close this edition of the podcast with their new song, No Time to Die, written for the Bond film of the same name, due out this April. That's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.
Faces from my best return.